Thank you. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's been really a great workshop. I want to talk about, actually after Dima's great introduction, I'm going to talk about some more specific things in many-body localization. I'll focus mainly on the many-body localization transition. And this work was done with my student Ronen Vosk at Weizmann and with David Hughes, and I'll mention in the beginning some related work done with different collaborators. Okay, again, Dima has mentioned it already, but this talk is going to be somewhat beyond the conventional wisdom in condensed matter physics. And usually the conventional wisdom is that quantum physics is apparent and manifest only in or very near to ground states of many-body systems. For example, quantum Hall states, topological insulators, Fermi liquids, quantum critical points are all sharply defined, that's what we think, only at zero temperature. But as I said, this talk will discuss quantum behavior and entanglement where we don't usually expect to discuss these things at high energy. So why can I discuss this? Well, first of all, why people usually think you cannot, the usual paradigm for high energy states is that they thermalize. So if we put a system in a high energy, some generic high energy state, let it evolve in time, it will thermalize. Now we know that Dima has talked about a different alternative to thermalization, but the usual concept we have is thermalization. Now, if a system thermalizes, then if initially we have some quantum correlations that we prepare in the system, there is some entangled pairs somewhere, these pairs actually get entangled with many, many other degrees of freedom in the system, and that quantum information rapidly becomes inaccessible because the entanglement spreads over the entire system. It becomes highly non-local, you cannot retrieve it anymore. So when you cannot retrieve it anymore, everything becomes essentially, so much entanglement becomes like noise. The only structures that remain in the system are slow modes of conserved quantities and maybe order parameter fields, and these are described by classical hydrodynamics. So we know if a system thermalizes at long times, it will be described classically, even though, you know, the underlying microscopics is quantum mechanical. There is emergent classical behavior. In a many-body localized system, as Dima pointed out, oops, oh, this shouldn't have happened. In a many-body localized system, as Dima pointed out, quantum information can persist indefinitely for a very long time. So I can prepare a qubit somewhere here, let the system evolve, it interacts with many, many other degrees of freedom at high energies, and nonetheless, you can actually retrieve this quantum information in the qubit even after infinite time, or at least part of this quantum information persists at infinite time. So for that, you need a fully quantum description, even of the long-time dynamics. So already you can see that the transition between these two types of behaviors should be very interesting, because it's really a transition, a sharp interface between a macroscopic world dominated by classical physics and one dominated by quantum mechanics. And that's in itself very interesting and I think not very well understood. Another perspective of the same problem is gained by looking at eigenstates. So Dima has mentioned the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So a thermalizing system, if you look at the high energy state of a thermalizing system, basically the equivalence of ensembles suggests that even that any local observable inside this eigenstate will actually look like a thermal observable. And in particular, if you look at the entanglement entropy of some limited confined region inside this big system, so L is the size of the subsystem here, then the entanglement entropy should behave like the thermal entropy, which is a volume law, okay? So that's essentially almost clear. But in a many-body localized system, the eigenstates have very low entanglement. They have area low entanglement. So the transition between these two types of states, again, is very dramatic. It's unlike any other phase transition we know in nature. It separates states with volume law from states with area law entanglement. For example, quantum phase transitions actually separate states with area law from other states with area law entanglement, modulo some possible logarithmic corrections. And if you want to think of thermal transitions in a microcanonical quantum description, then they separate volume law states from volume law states. But we never actually encounter transitions, well, except for non-generic ones like non-interacting Anderson localization transition that separate volume law from area law states. So this is kind of the only generic transition we know that is expected to do something like that. So can we use a conventional scheme like a renormalization group framework to understand both the many-body localized state and especially the transition between the many-body localized state and a delocalized state? So this is the conventional scheme. It separates quantum phases. We basically look at the flow at low energies and coarse grain the system. And when we go to low temperature, it gives us a natural reason to look at lower and lower energies. The problem here is that we want to look at the system at high energies. All energies play a role. So the usual philosophy of integrating out high energy states doesn't really work. We need a different approach if we want to use a renormalization group framework. So that would be part of what I want to discuss in this talk. So the outline will be, before getting into the many-body localization transition, I want to warm up and try to formulate an effective description of the many-body localized phase using a renormalization group. And in that framework, and from this point of view, discuss some of what Dima has talked about, like the emergence of quasi-local integrals of motion and integrability of this state. And then try to see how one can formulate a renormalization group approach that will capture the transition into the delocalized state. And I've written here, maybe I'll talk about experimental observation of many-body localization, but I don't think I'll reach it. Mainly I wrote it here, if I have time, I'll reach it, but I mainly wrote it here to remind you that this is not really an abstract, completely abstract field. There are now experiments, and one can try to test and confront theory with experiment. So let me start with the effective description of the many-body localized phase. And well, one starting point for to try to understand what happens in a many-body localized phase is to take a model Hamiltonian, like say, this is a transverse field Ising model supplemented by some more terms in order to make it generic. We don't want it to be an integrable system. We want it to be a generic system. Without this term, it will be essentially equivalent to free fermions. So we have this model. We start the system in some, this is just one possibility of doing a thought experiment in this model at high energies. Start with this, some unentangled state, like this classical spin state where some of the spins are up, some are down, and then take the state and evolve it in time using this Hamiltonian and ask how do correlations develop and how entanglement develops and so on. So how do we treat this time evolution using RG? There is a kind of obvious thing to do is to separate the coupling constants, because they're all random, to small and large ones, and pick out the largest coupling constants anywhere. For example, if there is a large transverse field somewhere here acting on this spin, then the spin will process very, very fast, and the spins around it will be affected by much smaller fields and couplings, and therefore will be essentially frozen on the time that this spin oscillates. So if you do that, you can actually solve exactly this local problem at the time scale 1 over omega, which corresponds to your running cutoff, you solve this exactly. And then by time-dependent perturbation theory, you see how this fast evolution of this spin, you eliminate it, and it affects an effective coupling between the nearby spins. And you repeat, and you take out more and more high energy couplings from your model and go down to lower and lower energy couplings. Now, in what sense is this different from the, it's very similar to the usual strong disorder RG philosophy in the ground state. The basic difference, which I'll highlight in a minute, even in a different way, is that in this strong disorder, in the usual strong disorder RG, I actually take, at each point, I throw out the high energy state and I am left only with the low energy state. Okay, so I focus, as I continue the flow, I focus to low at low energies. Here I can't do that. I actually focus at long times. What is affecting the evolution at very long times? It's not low energy, it's small energy differences in the spectrum. So actually what I focus on is low frequencies, which correspond to low energy differences rather than low absolute energy. There is another nice way to understand it. In essence, you expect that I'm not allowed to throw out states in this. I'm not allowed to eliminate states. I cannot eliminate states from my spectrum because I want to look at high energies at all the spectrum. So how does this RG progresses without throwing states? What's the use of doing renormalization group? So a nice way to view it is, here is the Hamiltonian. What do we actually do in each elimination step? We actually rotate the Hamiltonian with some unitary transformation, which decouples the high and low energy subspace of this local cluster. So if this is a large transverse field, after this transformation, it's like a Schrieffer-Wolf transformation, for those of you who know the name. After this transformation, we have essentially decoupled these subspaces from the rest of the system. So if we had a large transverse field Sx, after this transformation, we arrive at this Hamiltonian. And you see that this spin Sx, after we rotated it, became a conserved quantity. It commutes with everything else in the Hamiltonian. So the bottom line is that the output of this RG, the RG is creating more and more conserved quantities. Every step of the RG has created a new conserved quantity, and when we're done, all the spins in the system have been converted into conserved quantities. So this is the conserved quantity. It's not completely local. It has an overlap with the original spin, but it has some exponential tail of strings of operators that become longer and longer, only the coefficients for longer and longer strings become smaller and smaller exponentially. So after we have done all these transformations, in the end we arrive at essentially the same kind of fixed point Hamiltonian that Dima has postulated exists. But we see that this Hamiltonian is really a stable RG fixed point, which is another evidence that the many-body localized phase, although it has this integrable structure of an integrable model, this integrable model is robust.
How does the tilde field is defined?
Yeah, so it's defined basically by the series of unitary transformations that you need to do in order to arrive at it. Yes, right. Right. So this is also approximate, right? Right, because these, you just do them to second order in this strong disorder RG, and that's approximate at the initial stages. You hope that when you get to the end of the RG, the disorder becomes so large that second order perturbation theory becomes better and better controlled. Yeah. So really, during this RG, you construct them effectively. I just wanted to mention another thing, that this is completely analogous. It's very much analogous with what happens at low energy fixed points. For example, the Fermi liquid theory is a low energy fixed point, and you see it's integrable. It's written completely in terms of conserved quantities, which are these n of k's, the quasi-particle distribution functions, the difference is that these operators don't span the entire Hilbert space of operators. They live only on a very, very thin shell. While these operators actually span the entire Hilbert space or a large portion of it. Okay, and using this Hamiltonian, one can already gain a lot of insight into the many-body localized phase. I'll not go into that because Dima talked about many of these things. The bottom line, though, is that this approach basically does local moves. And it neglects the possibility of having long-range resonances. And exactly these long-range resonances is what brings about delocalization. So just using this RG as it is will not tell us anything about the many-body localization phase transition. So to treat that, I'll need to introduce a different approach. So how do we treat the many-body localization phase transition? The approach we decided to take is to somehow give up the microscopic description in terms of a well-defined Hamiltonian with of spins and interactions between spins. And we wanted to think, like you often do when you search for a fixed point in field theory, this is not field theory, but in that sense it's similar, what would be the structure of the theory close to the fixed point? And it's one way to think about it is that after, when you're very close to the fixed point, because the disorder is to the critical point, because the disorder is the system is disordered, some regions will look more like they're in the metallic phase, and other regions, because of large scale fluctuations, will look more like they're in the insulating phase. So you'll have these insulating regions and metallic regions. Only they're not going to be true insulators and not true metals because each of these regions are just finite size. Okay, so the idea is that if these thermalizing regions, if you have, for example, two big thermalizing regions, they're much bigger than an insulating region between them, these thermalizing regions will be able to thermalize or quasi-thermalize this insulating region. And at longer timescales, if we look at this at longer timescales, also this will look thermal, and so on. So that will allow us to do some kind of RG transformation I'll discuss in a minute. But before discussing how this works, let's try to understand the regions. So each region is like a puddle. It's described by many, many parameters. And we're going to assume that only two parameters are really important. And the two parameters are the level spacing. So there is a many-body spectrum of this isolated region. If I isolate this region, it has a many-body spectrum, and it has level spacing delta. That's the mean level spacing of the block. It's exponentially small with the number of spins, of course. And there is also a time for entanglement to spread across the block. Or we call this entanglement thermalization time. I'll define it more precisely in a minute. But it's the time it would take an external reservoir to thermalize this block. So now we can define a dimensionless ratio between these two quantities, g. If g is much smaller than 1, if the ratio between gamma, the thermalization rate, and delta, the level spacing, is much smaller than 1, then this is an insulating block or a localized block. And we expect that the levels will have Poisson statistics, while if the thermalization time is much larger than the level spacing, basically the system had time to thermalize before it had some recurrences due to quantum oscillations due to the level spacing, then we call this an incipient thermalizing block. And it will have Wigner-Dyson statistics. Okay, there are still not real thermalizing systems or real insulators, they're finite size. So the idea of this RG flow is to iteratively join matrices that entangle with each other at the fastest rates and thermalize each other. And at the end of the flow, we are going to be left with just one big puddle, and we're going to ask whether this puddle is insulating or thermal, and that will be sharply defined because it will be infinite. This puddle will be infinite. So just before I continue to describe the RG scheme, let me digress a little bit and tell you about the difference between entanglement spread and transport time. So how do we envision this time scale, tau, or rate gamma that I told you of a test block gamma? So as I said, the way to test that is to connect a reservoir at some time. T equals zero, I'm going to connect with a local matrix element V, a reservoir that's conducting, with my test block. And I'm going to test how long it takes a system to thermalize in the entanglement sense. What does it mean? Well, I'm going to, the reservoir, let me assume that it's in an energy level. It's in an eigenstate of it, of the reservoir. It doesn't have to be, but it's simple to think of an eigenstate. And the test block is in an eigenstate of the test block. And now I connect them. How long does it take the entanglement, them to fully entangle with each other? Okay, that's the question. And one can answer it maybe if the connection was weak, one could try to answer this with Fermi golden rule. And you see that the time it takes to entangle, basically one transition, one Fermi golden rule transition is enough to fully entangle them. Because one Fermi golden rule type transition makes a transition of the two energy states by order one energy. But within an order one energy, because this is a many-body system, they're order 2 to the L states. So the entanglement entropies, and you don't know which state it goes to. It goes to all of them, essentially. So the entanglement grows by to order L, to volume law entanglement already after a transition of order one energy. And that's what we call the entanglement thermalization rate. Why is it different than a usual thermalization rate? Because you will need L such transitions to equilibrate the energy density of the two blocks, right? Because that transition changes the energy only by order one. To equilibrate the energy density, you need to make L such transitions to make an extensive change in the energy. So the transport time, which is the time to equilibrate temperature or energy densities, is L times the entanglement thermalization time. Okay, so there is a difference between transport time and entanglement thermalization time, but we know this, the connection between them. And that actually implies that if we look at the dynamical critical exponent, Z, if we have Z for transport, then we'll have, if we have Z for entanglement, then we'll have Z plus one for transport. And that means for, yeah? Okay, so you have a question?
Actually, is it clear that this relation would hold if your system is not fully thermal, but somewhere in between? Or would it be substituted with some maybe Pauli law?
I think it's still, this has, if it's fully thermal, well, okay, this is for thermal states. There is fully ergodic, yeah. If it's not fully ergodic, maybe if it's not fully ergodic, we'll see that there is no Z actually. So there is nothing to talk about. But if it's ergodic, you have a Z. So for example, here is an example. Diffusive metal, Z equals two, but that means that entanglement dynamical exponent is one. So entanglement spreads ballistically when energy spreads diffusively. Okay, so what is the starting point for the RG? I connect these, I have these puddles, and I connect them with links. And these links are also labeled by gammas and g's. And the meaning of these gammas and g's is very simple. The link variables just mean if I take and isolate two such blocks, not one, but two, what will be the new gammas, the rate end-to-end the thermalization time, and new delta, the level spacing of the two blocks coupled together. So if we take them as a test block, that's the only thing. And we're not going to calculate it now. In the initial state, this is given. Okay, this is given, and now we're going to work from this.
G is delta?
No, G, so delta is the mean level spacing of the two block systems together. So it's it scales as 2 to the minus length of the two block system. Gamma is the end-to-end entanglement rate, and G is the ratio.
Oh,
Okay, so G much larger than one is what we call a thermalizing or effective link, and G much smaller than one is an ineffective link. And now the RG progresses like that. We take the largest link rate, and then we decide that this largest link rate means that we should take these two together, and they become a single block. So that hasn't been really, there is no calculation here. You just copy that into that. The calculation is where the real work is to ask, now what is the new rate that couples this newly joined block with the right and to the and with the left? And that's a real calculation, because now you have to actually solve a three block problem. So the three block problem, the end-to-end thermalization rate of three blocks will be this gamma r. And end-to-end thermalization block rate of these three blocks, one, two, three, will be the gamma left. Okay? So given the one and two block rates, you'll need to calculate the three block rates. So now, in this way, we compute the flow. If we have the prescription for how to calculate this, then we can compute the flow. And in the end, we get two possible fixed points. Two simple fixed points would be one when G is much larger than one at the end of the left block, and that's a thermalizing fixed point. And there is an insulating fixed point. See, I have to rush a bit. So there are two simple limits where we can derive these RG rules. One of them is when all of these are insulators, and then we have one rule. The rule when they're all insulators is something that you can derive even microscopically from perturbation theory, and you can guess very easily. When they're conductors, then you try to derive anything microscopically, you fail, because actually when the system is ergodic, everything is very complicated. Luckily, you know the answer. The answer is that you'll have Ohm's law. If the system are truly thermal, you'll have Ohm's law for energy transport, and you'll have the ballistic law for entanglement transport, and this is what you put in, kind of by hand. Okay, so this part is phenomenological, because we know that if the system is thermal, that's what you'll get. So by this we capture the big insulating and conducting areas. Now we just have to treat interfaces, and what one can show is that if these G's are either much larger than one or much smaller than one, and we don't have anything kind of in the middle, then you can use the same rules also for interfaces. So is that a correct assumption? You'll have to a posteriori check whether the distribution you get give you a large probability of finding G somewhere of order one. Okay, so this is the outcome of a flow. For example, I plot here log of G as a function of L, and you see that log of G grows linearly, which means G grows exponentially in the case of a delocalized system, and it decays linearly, which means G decays exponentially as a function of the scale. This is scale, it's not the length. This is as a function of the scale if the system is MBL. So now let's look at this flow a little bit more in detail. What's the structure of the critical point? It turns out that a very good description of the critical point can begin from understanding entanglement properties. So we don't know how to strictly calculate the eigenstate entanglement entropy, but we can calculate something that is closely related to it. So what we do is we take a very long chain and renormalize it until we have just two blocks left. When we have two blocks left and there is one link, the gamma between these links corresponds to a Fermi-Golden rule-like rate for decay. But you can think of it also in terms of static perturbation theory, stationary perturbation theory, as you can think of G as the number of expansion coefficients you have of two block eigenstates that you need in order to express a the real eigenstate of the connected blocks. And that, so the entanglement entropy of this full system or half system is log of this g plus 1. Plus 1 is not so crucial here. It's just that if g is equal to 0, it means that there is still one state. Okay, and that is something we can compute from the flow. We just run it on the computer, we compute the flow, and we get it for, so we do it for a system that begins with 100 sites, 200 sites, up to 10,000 sites, and we get the entanglement entropy, these are the curves, over the normalized by what we expect in a thermal system, and you see that it's like a smooth step that goes to one. This is one here, 1 minute, okay. It's a smooth step that becomes sharper and sharper, and it suggests to do scaling. So when we scale this, we scale the x-axis. So we look at the tuning parameter. Tuning parameter is some parameter of the initial distribution minus critical value times L to some exponent 1 over nu. We get that all the curves for both S and the fluctuation of S collapse on a single curve, which implies that there is very good scaling here. And you see that we have, so we have perfect collapse for this critical exponent. This is the localization length critical exponent. It tells you how the localization length diverges at the critical point. But the bottom line from this is that the entanglement shows a universal transition from area law, which means zero here, to the full volume law, the full thermal volume law. Oh, there is no Griffith phase yet. Okay, so the last thing I want to show is dynamics. So I talked about entanglement entropy. There is also a dynamical, we can extract information about dynamics. So if we take a system of size L, we expect that the time it takes transport to go from one side to the other, if it was diffusive, would be L squared. Or the length would go like time to the power half if this was diffusive. And the first thing we wanted to understand is how the diffusion coefficient vanishes as you go to the critical point. So we plotted L versus the entanglement time, the typical entanglement time, and plotted it on a log-log curve. So this is log-log, and expected to see many curves with coefficient half, with slope half, but actually what you see is something very different. You see that the slope changes as you go to the localized phase. So actually, if you plot this slope, you see that it's, the slope alpha, the coefficient, the exponent alpha is smaller than half, and it decreases continuously and vanishes at the transition. So what we find is that actually, instead of vanishing diffusion constant, we have a subdiffusive phase where the critical exponent, where alpha vanishes continuously, or if you want, the dynamical critical exponent z diverges at the critical point. So, and this is very easy to understand, actually. This is a Griffith phase. We have inside the, if you go into the, if you come to the critical point from the conducting side, you have long regions that are you can find insulators of the size of the localization length easily, but it's very rare to find insulating inclusions much larger than the correlation length. But when we find one, it delays transport by an exponentially large amount, and therefore they have a very important effect, and they dominate the transport and make it subdiffusive. So that's easy to understand from this Griffith regime. So let me summarize. There are two paradigms we know today, many-body localization and thermalization. What I showed you is that many-body localized phase can be understood as a dynamical renormalization fixed point that describes a robust integrable behavior, and the many body localization phase transition is described by RG defined on a space of random matrices. It gives two interesting predictions. One, that there is a subdiffusive phase before you enter the full metallic behavior, but the subdiffusive behavior is in a fully ergodic system. And the second is that the critical point is actually an infinite randomness critical point where the entanglement entropy is broadly distributed at the critical point. And the question, because of this crowd, is that whether there is a dual description, gravity description for this transition. And to me, at least, it's very suggestive of merging of small black holes into a big black hole. If you think about it, the random matrices that describe the incipient thermal behavior are like small black holes, but they're only black holes at timescales that are smaller than the level spacing. That's why they're really quantum black holes. And only if they merge with many other black holes to make one infinite one do they really give you a thermal state. And that's the type of transition I expect here. So thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. I have a quick one. Can you tell if there are different universality classes? Like, I assume this will all be in one spatial dimension for now, but yeah. Does it make a difference if I have an Imbri-like model with only a Z2 symmetry versus having a conserved charge, like a U1 charge?
Sorry, again? Sorry.
Well, like, what I'm wondering about is, what are the universality classes? So, for example, in the XXZ model, it has been studied a lot, there's a conserved charge, a current, U1 current.
Right.
While in the Imbri-type model, there isn't.
Yeah. So you mean different universality classes for the many-body localization phase transition?
Yes. So, for example, you put up a critical exponent.
Right.
Would you expect that to be the same for those two classes or different?
It's a good question. I think if you have just global conservation laws, I suspect that it's not going to change much. Here we have energy conservation, and I think we could have eliminated energy conservation because it doesn't play any role. Actually, we actually even played with a model where there is no energy conservation, so you can think about it as Floquet, and that didn't change anything. So if there is no energy conservation, anyways, the only thing we treat is entanglement propagation, which is the fastest. The conserved quantities, anyways, are much slower. So I think because they lag behind, they don't have any effect on the actual transition. That's my intuition, but I don't know because I haven't calculated. It would be more complicated to put in more conserved quantities.
So I'm wondering, this is essentially RG for dynamics.
Right? Yes.
So now, if you want to think about eigenstates, so in principle, right, if we form a big connected kind of ergodic region, right, it can then also eat up smaller insulating regions if we think about eigenstates.
Yes.
Right? So it would,
I think it will be the same thing. Yeah.
But do you take this into account in RG or no? Let's say if you try to calculate entanglement, right?
Yeah, so I don't calculate entanglement in eigenstates. The only way I calculate entanglement in eigenstates is I make connection between, at least in perturbative connect, there is a perturbative connection between first order perturbation theory for the eigenstates and the Fermi-Golden rule rate for entanglement generation. So I don't know how to calculate true entanglement in a single eigenstate. There is no access here to single eigenstates. What would be nice, and something I'm trying to kind of think about, is to describe how the eigenstate develops as, instead of thinking of time evolution, thinking of a quantum circuit that, like a mirror description of starting from a very simple state and trying to evolve into this thermal state would involve a very long depth, high depth operator, and describing the non-thermal state would involve finite depth. So that might be a description for eigenstates directly. but we don't do that here. This is more like a phenomenological approach.
Matthew?
Could you comment on the relation between your way of thinking about this transition and what Tarun told us?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Tarun doesn't have a theory for the transition. He has a constraint on how the transition can occur. And I think what we get is broadly consistent with that, although we don't have a way to calculate the subsystem entanglement entropy. There is one little thing that I didn't talk about, but actually bugs me a little bit and makes it a little bit less consistent maybe than I would with Tarun's. So let me show you one thing. So this is log g. Log g is not entanglement entropy, but it has sort of the sense of entanglement entropy. It's not entanglement entropy. But now when I try to scale this fan, I can try to scale this fan. I didn't do that. How does it? I need to go to here. When I try to scale it, then I get the Milky Way. I get really great scaling on the thermal side, where it looks like below the localization length, the thermal states behave like insulators. But in the insulating side, there is no scaling. You see different insulators behave differently. However, in order, and we tried a long time to get scaling in the insulating side. And then we finally found a way to get scaling in the insulating side is to plot, instead of average of log g, which is like the entanglement, something like entanglement entropy, plot the log of average g, okay? So the fan looks similar, but then when we do the scaling, it scales on the in the insulating side. Now, why does it scale so well when we plot the average of g rather than the average of log g? It's probably because what drives the transition is a very rare metallic cluster that really doesn't affect any typical properties, but because and G in this metallic cluster is exponentially large with the size of this cluster, but if you take the log of that G, it's not affecting the average. But if you average the E to the S, you do. So somehow, I suspect that this does have some implication to what Tarun is saying, that it might be that most of the eigenstates near the transition will simply not show this thermal behavior even at short distances. There will only be very rare eigenstates or very rare regions in each eigenstate that will show this behavior. So that's maybe what is somehow related to Tarun's description.
Okay, are there any particularly urgent? I guess we should let Tarun speak.
Yeah.
It's not, one question I had was, is it true that within this strong disorder way of thinking, the fact that you get, I believe you get z is equal to infinity at a transition?
Yes.
Was there a chance of something which is not infinity?
Yes.
I see.
There was a chance. So, from my experience with real space RG, you actually like to get these infinite randomness critical points because then your RG is well controlled at the critical point.
Right.
But, Gil was here, but I had some other problem I worked on with him where we actually hope to get an infinite randomness critical point, and you get in the end a finite randomness critical point. So the fact that you hope for it and you postulate that you'll get it in your RG rules doesn't mean that this is what you eventually get. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we got it was kind of encouraging. It's not clear that you would get it.
One comment on Matt's question, actually,
yeah,
is that this G actually cannot be entanglement because, as Ahud showed me the data, it actually doesn't satisfy strong subadditivity at all. So no. it completely misses, even if you go back to just average value of G directly, whatever, what you would call average value of S in the metallic phase, it has this dip. So it cannot be.
Yeah, this is definitely not entanglement.
Right,
it's just a local quantity, right? It's not,
right,
entanglement
is
really affected by other clusters as well. Yeah, so I fully agree.
So then you can't really Yeah. The question cannot be answered.
Yeah, it's not. I cannot specifically say how the entanglement entropy will behave. The finite system behind subsystem entanglement entropy.
Yeah, but even for the half system we can't say because this is not entangled.
Right. Okay. This entanglement is just half system entanglement doesn't have subadditivity.
No. Yeah. I'm saying that the fact that the reason you called it half system entanglement was there's some intuition. I'm saying that intuition cannot be fully correct because if I take it seriously, I think of it like entanglement, it doesn't have those properties. So
okay, yeah, I call it eigenstate diagonal entropy. But then, yeah,
right.
Okay, we can.
Okay, I think we better move on to the next talk. Let's thank Ehud again.
Thanks.